2 days later, they entered the lands where Dante believed the Nine Pines spent the winters. The rough hills, some grassy, some pine-coated, that abutted the mighty river demarcating the border between human and Norrin. Morn still hadn't answered his loon. It must have been destroyed or lost. Or its owner was. Dante rode from ridge to ridge, checking every stream and pond big enough to sustain a clan of 50-plus Norrin. At one, they found fish bones, still clean and white, and filled in latrines. Tracks indicated the Norrin had headed upstream. A couple miles later, they found more bones and refuse. The third such site was fresh enough you could still smell the dung. It was at the end of the line, a hill-fed pond out of which the stream sprung. But they hadn't seen a single Norrin all the while. C towed a chunk of antler that had been deemed unfit for carving. "These guys are supposed to be friends of yours, right?" "I'm closer to many of them than I am to my own clan. Why?" She stood. "Looks funny, that's all." With no more trail to follow, they burned 2 more days crisscrossing the hills. These felt endless, but the territory of any given clan was relatively circumscribed, and Dante thought they'd covered much of the Nine Pines grounds. On the clan borders, which were unmarked, permeable, and elastic, they twice ran into other clans, one of whom Dante knew fairly well. He stopped to explain the situation to the chief, and was allowed to address the entire clan. Unsurprisingly, most had little interest in running off to die for Narashtivik, but 2 young men and 1 middle-aged woman volunteered on the spot. He asked them to head to the citadel as soon as they could. Both clans claimed to have seen the Nine Pines recently, and suggested they were still in the area. Dante got Nak to loon the tribes Narashtivik was in contact with. None had seen Morn or his people, but Nak informed Dante, with no small pride, that he'd been able to convince 3 warriors to join the cause. Dante wondered if he should give up on Morn and visit the other clans instead. There were thousands of Norrin scattered across the hills, and Dante would be happy to come away with just a score of recruits. But he trusted Morn and the Nine Pines above all others, both personally and as warriors. Anyway, at this point he was starting to get worried about them. On the morning of their 6th day since leaving Narashtivik, with 3 to go before they'd need to head home, C returned from foraging with a sack of frostberries and an odd look on her face. She glanced back to the trees. "You up for something really stupid?" "You're going to have to be more specific about the nature of this stupid. Is it potentially lethal stupid?" "Nothing that would get you killed. More likely you'll want to crawl into a hole until the shame goes away." "That's where all my best ideas come from," Dante said. "Let's get dumb." "Great. Hand over your clothes." "You didn't say anything about nude stupidity." She rolled her eyes. "Your spears and your cloak, let's go." He handed over his cloak and the change of clothes he carried in case he got soaked or soiled. C glanced into the woods again and carried his clothes and her pack into a thicket. Twigs snapped. Leaves crunched. Dante sat on a rock and tallied up the other clans who might be worth contacting. If they called off the hunt for the Nine Pines today, they could take a meandering route back to Narashtivik, with time to speak to several clans along the way. That decided it. Better to come back with his second choices than to return with nothing. C emerged from the brush, dragging a bulky object that snagged in the twigs and thorns. "What?" Dante started. She shushed him. "Get in the thicket. Don't say a word. Got it?" He nodded and moved past her. She was lugging a scarecrow made from his clothes. As he settled himself inside the shrubs, she heaved it on top of his horse and lashed it in place. She mounted up and led his horse out into the clearing just past the trees. Dante crouched in the thorns, feeling as foolish as she'd promised. He was cold without his cloak, but not so much that he was shivering, yet. He didn't know how long he was supposed to wait. Until C decided to come back, he supposed. He wrapped his arms around his legs to stay warm. 10 minutes later, an animal rustled in the branches the opposite direction C had gone. Dante went still, ducking his head. 2 Norren walked through the trees, a man and a woman. Oh, hell. Dante stood and forced his way through the brambles, screening his eyes against the thorns. He emerged to the sight of 2 drawn bows. He sighed. The 2 Norren lowered their weapons, looking sheepish. How long have you been following us, Fen? The woman shouldered her bow. Couple of days. Where are the others? She was silent a moment. Following behind us? So you wouldn't ever see us, the male added, confirming what Fen had implied. Dante had met him before, but couldn't recall his name offhand. Dante cupped his hands to his mouth. Hey, see, they fell for it. He turned to Fen. Well, come on, let's go see Morn. C rode back, grinning in triumph. She shook the leaves from Dante's clothes and handed them over. He walked his horse behind the 2 Nine Pine scouts. Morn and the others were encamped in tents in the woods a couple miles away, on ground Dante and C had covered earlier that day. As soon as they arrived, Morn walked out to meet them, massive shoulders rolling. Oh, there you are. Why do I feel like you already know why I'm here? Dante said. Because you're reasonably intelligent. Morn shook his head. This sounds like madness. Dante's face fell. You won't help us. The Norren lifted his eyes. I didn't say anything about whether I or the Nine Pines would help. All I said was this sounded like madness, as mad as trying to swallow your own bones. But your bones are already inside you. Exactly. If you didn't say you won't help us, does that mean you will? I still haven't said anything about that, have I? Morn's shoulders slumped. Of course I'll say yes. What? Then why hide from me? So I wouldn't have to say yes. Dante bent with laughter. I don't know if I've heard you more miserable in all my life. Me neither. As long as you're here spoiling my day, you may as well take some of my stew, too. He led Dante and C to a blanket on the grass. Someone had started a fire beside it, and a handful of Norren were poking at the kindling and setting up racks and pots above it. The air filled with the smell of roasting potatoes and melting fat. While they waited for it to cook through, Dante related the full story. Morn had the broad strokes, presumably from Hop or one of the others Nak had spoken to, but was missing many of the fine touches. "Blazes back," Morn said. Somehow that's more surprising than anything else. Dante eyed the simmering stew. He hadn't had a hot meal in days. He feels guilty about handing Selen over to the minister, but getting it back will likely mean violence, and then he'll feel guilty about that and run off again. A person who feels guilty about hurting others, he sickens me. It isn't the guilt that's the problem. We all feel it. But he lets it rule him, even when we had no other choice, when our actions made the world a better place. Someone handed Morn a bowl of stew. He held on to it, ignoring the steam curling from its thick surface.
And you can set it down, like I can set down this bowl.
In time? Of course.
Morn honked with laughter. You don't know how lucky you are.
Dante had nothing to say to this. You still haven't told me what you think of the plan.
I think that if I die, I'll be able to quit pretending I know how to lead this clan.
Is it really that bad?
Don't tell me you like being in charge of Narashtovik, because now that I think about it, I know you do. So telling me that would be redundant.
Morn gazed across his people as they ate and worked and talked.
The only thing that I've learned as a leader is that I'm not fit to lead. And neither is anyone else.
Someone delivered Dante his owl bowl of stew, and conversation ceased for a while. After he finished it, he sat back, comfortably stuffed, lips slick with grease. Without warning, Morn stood. He stared into the twilight and raised his voice to his clan.
I'm about to ask you if you want to do something very foolish. Foolish in the sense it will be dangerous to your physical well-being. Some of those who go with us may not make it back, because we won't be able to carry the bodies back with us.
He paused. Possibly it was a dramatic choice, letting his people conjure up wild scenarios in their heads. But Dante thought he was doing just what he appeared to be doing, fighting to find the best way to express what he felt inside.
But perhaps it would be foolish not to go, because our goal is to avert a war against Narashtovik. They are being attacked because of a crime committed so long ago that no one in these lands remembers that it happened. They have no choice in the matter. But we do. And here is our question. Do you value Narashtovik's existence enough to risk your own?
Pale things moved in the firelight, hands being raised. Not all of them, not even a third, but it was as many as Dante could have hoped for. Yet, as he sat beside Morn, watching as people with no ties of blood or power to Narashtovik pledged to fight for it, sadness coiled in his chest. Because Morn was right. Some of these people would die. And Dante was the one who had brought that death to them.
Chapter 36. A thick cloud of powdered stone gushed from the wall. Blaze turned and pulled his cloak over his face. The dust whispered over him, layering the damp grass. Min stood undaunted, face caked with it. She flipped back her cloak, knocking it off with a flourish.
You will listen to me, Ro. Selin has returned, and it has been taken.
Ro remained standing at the edge of the cliffs. She was an intimidating leader, and knew the best time for an exit is after a dramatic moment like pulverizing a staircase. The fact she was listening made Blaze think Min might have a chance.
So what? Ro said. The man who took it is from Wesley. He still blames Narashtovik for the devastation of his homeland. He's going to use Selin to destroy them.
I say again, so what?
It's a crime they had no true part in. If anyone deserves to be punished, we do. It's our responsibility to save them. Hiding here is wrong.
We washed our hands of Narashtovik and all it represents an age ago, Ro said. It was their decision to stay.
Min lowered her eyes and glared at the dark cliffs. Blaze could see her willing herself to calm down.
Ro, you don't even know what you're refusing. We could save thousands of lives at no risk to ourselves. If you let me up to talk to you for 5 minutes...
Blaze touched her arm. She's gone. Min lifted her gaze back to the cliffs. The three women were nowhere to be seen.
Ro!
The wind answered, shuffling through the grass. Blaze folded his arms.
Should we go, then?
Min turned on him.
Should we go? Your whole city is depending on us.
That's true, which is unfortunate for them, given that we can't force Ro and all your friends to march 800 miles across the continent and then burrow their way through another 100 miles of mountains.
All we have to do is get inside Pocket Cove. If I can make Ro hold a real conversation with me, I know she'll see reason.
Reasonable isn't the word I'd use for Ro. More like intractable.
I don't believe you'd come up with a plan this good, spend the next 6 days dashing across the country to see it through, then turn around at the first hint of resistance.
Hint? Blaze laughed. You call destroying our only path into your home a hint? If you tried to rebuild the stairs at this point, what do you think they'd do?
The same thing they would have done to you if you hadn't gone away. Bury us in a rock slide.
Is that a subtle way of reminding me how much I owe you?
Blaze put his hands on his hips and shot a nasty look at the beetle trundling over the tip of his boot.
Well, if we can't get in by going over, we'll have to go around.
By boat?
Why not? I mean, besides the fact we don't have one,
Min said slowly, working this through.
At the north end of the bay, the sea flows from the north between Fo'o Island and the mainland. From there it sweeps around the curve of the cove. All we'd have to do is build a raft. The tides will take care of the rest.
It was growing dark, but Blaze didn't waste a minute. They untied the horses and followed the cliffs north, slowing as the light faded. The rock wall curled west to meet the sea.
You're sure we can't just build some stairs right here?
Blaze jerked his chin at the walls to their left.
We must be 15 miles away from our last encounter. Surely they're not watching every foot of their turf.
No, but they're in tune with it. They have to be. If Garsk ever tried another invasion, we have to be able to sense it before the king's army would be able to scale the cliffs.
Blaze found it hard to believe they could keep tabs on so much space, but he kept his trap shut. They'd built this place, after all. Maybe that gave them a special connection to it. Anyway, he and Min had another plan. They set up camp beside the northern cliffs. Surf rolled through the darkness, but the noise was thin, and Blaze knew sound traveled far on the seaside air. When morning came around, he saw that he was right. They couldn't even see the ocean. But after a quick ride, they were upon it by early morning. To their left, which was now the south, the cliffs extended into the water and stopped cold. An island hung a few miles off the coast. All they had to do was put together a vessel, then hop into the channel.
And do a hell of a lot of praying, because there were no villagers in sight, and Blaze hadn't exactly come laden with his shipwright's tools. He had an axe, but it was a hatchet for whacking twine and twigs. It would barely be able to dent the rugged trees along the shore. He did, however, have a length of thin rope, the sort of thing you carry whenever you rode out into the wilds, and a whole bunch of blankets and canvas. While Min cut these into strips, Blaze lugged driftwood from the beach and gathered fallen logs from the patchy forest. It didn't have to be pretty. It didn't even have to last all that long, frankly. They could probably make it by clinging to a loose pile of branches. He didn't love the idea of dangling in the water across 5+ miles, however, not only because of the horrible cold, but also the infinitely more horrible sharks. Now that the ocean had had all winter to cool down, maybe it was too frigid for sharks, but chilly waters hadn't stopped the one at Ko'o from spoiling their day. He spent the early morning lashing together a platform of mismatched logs. It wasn't the sort of thing they'd be able to sell, but it looked like it would do the trick. He dragged it down to the sand.
"Are there any wolves or other large predators around here?"
Blaze asked. "I mean, besides Ro."
"Not this close to see. Why?"
"Just curious."
Leaving the horses tied up seemed cruel, probably because it was. But it was either that or bid them farewell. That, in turn, would mean running on their own legs to Galador and picking up horses from Lolligan. The return trip would take twice as long. He made a silent vow to come back for them. If anything happened in the meantime, they'd have to be another sacrifice to the greater good. Blaze shelved the thought and pushed the raft into the surf. The water was testicle withdrawingly cold, but the waves weren't too bad. After a couple exhausting minutes, they were out in the strait. Just as Min predicted, the current swept them along the curl of the cove, drawing them along at a couple hundred yards from shore. Blaze had found flat pieces of driftwood to use as oars, but they proved useless against the waves and tides. They continued in the desired direction, however, the raft twirling slowly, just large enough to keep its surface above water, except during the roughest waves. They had to kneel to avoid losing their footing, and the shins and knees of their pants grew sodden. His loon pulsed. Blaze winced. He'd forgotten to check in with Knack last night. He could ignore it, but that would only raise more questions later. He got Min's attention and pointed to his ear, then said, "What's up?"
"Nothing special," Knack said. "Just checking to make sure you hadn't fallen off the end of the earth. Run into anything unusual?"
Blaze curled his arm over his head to try to block out the sound of the waves slopping over the raft.
"Nope. Still dead quiet on this front."
"Oh? You sound preoccupied."
"We're riding, that's all, very fast. Should probably pay attention to that, in fact. How about I tell you about it later?"
He closed down the loon. The smell of salt was dense in the air. A few gulls floated on the winds, cawing forlornly. The raft came around the top curve of the C-shaped bay and swept down the long north-south beach. Blaze thought he could see a canoe far to the south, checking the traps or the nets. A couple people might have been standing on the sand across from the canoe, but they were too far away to be certain.
Not for long, though.
Traversing the bay in this fashion reminded him how achingly small it had felt during his brief time there. From one tip of the sea to the other, the bay was about 12 miles across, 15 tops. He still didn't understand how the people could stand to spend their whole lives in such a limited space. Seeing it all at once, though, even from the less-than-sweeping perspective of a waterlogged raft, a less than a quarter mile from shore, it made a little more sense. You could spend years exploring its beaches, its tides, its flourishing pools, not to mention the fingers. The mist alone would make each visit feel like coming to a different place. It was its own little world. Its people were too. He'd hardly scratched their surface. Perhaps they were happier to be able to know their corner of things inside and out. Had it been a mistake to leave? Fumbling Selen straight into the minister's hand certainly felt like a cock-up of epic proportions. The kind of blunder so bad that all you could do was laugh. Laugh and start a mad dash across hundreds of miles to try to make amends. The thing was, going to Wending had not been a mistake. They'd saved Min's cousin, mended family rifts, foiled Tullivan's attempt to snatch the almanac, and bolster Modigan's effort to capture the Black Star. All that could be seen as nothing less than a good move. Capital G, capital M. In hindsight, it hadn't been necessary to continue to Setevan and chase down Kinnevan, maybe, but who knew? If the king's sorcerer had hung on to the Norrin idol, perhaps he could have beaten everyone to Selen. Stopping him had been another good move, then, if a lower-case one. The mistake, if there had been one, lay in going after Dante. There it was, his error glaring like the nimbuses in the quicksilver world of shadow-walking. He'd figured Dante would be up to something selfish and egotistical, and thus had to be beaten at all costs, but Blaze should have anticipated that everyone else pursuing Selen meant to use it for something far worse than personal gain.
"What's so funny?" Min said.
Let's just say we'd better get this done.
The raft floated along the coast. Sub-currents pushed and pulled it this way and that, but it never came closer than 100 yards to shore, nor further than double that. Blaze tried to adjust course with his paddle, but it was as useless as before. He set it on the deck.
We're going to have to swim in, aren't we?
Just figured that out.
We'll have to ditch our cloaks, maybe our boots too. If they refuse to see us, things are going to be crummy for a while.
Min's mouth twitched. If they refuse us, what does it matter what happens next?
Well, there's the fact that unless Ro's really upset with us, we'll still be alive, and thus in need of not stepping on sharp things and freezing to death.
Good thing I had you trained barefoot in the fingers.
The memory made him shiver.
Hang on. When we were in the Wodans, we were able to shadow walk over the top of the snow. What happens if you shadow walk on water?
You sink.
You sink on water, but not frozen water. What kind of sense does that make?
Let me ask Aron about that, Min said.
How should I know? You can walk on top of snow in the real world, too. It just crushes down some. If you were able to shadow walk on top of the water, that would be no different from flying, would it?
Which we can't do, so I suppose the netherworld retains some of the properties of the physical world it mirrors.
Do you swim through nether water just like the normal stuff?
Not exactly. You'll see.
They had come a couple miles down from the upper curve. To the south, the sea and beach were now deserted. A wave washed over the raft, soaking Blaze's folded leg some more. It was on the miserable side, there was no denying that. Not exactly breaking any speed records, either. When they were about a mile from the entrance to the tunnels, a steady diagonal current pushed them closer to land. Blaze paddled madly, trying to get them close enough that the breakers would push them in the rest of the way. But as the swells began to bulge, a riptide drew them away. He pulled off his boots, knotted them, and looped them around his neck. Min saw what he was doing and did the same. There was no saving his cloak, however. He transferred the contents of its pockets to his doublet and dropped it on the deck, where the heavy fabric immediately sopped up the seawater. The raft quit angling away and resumed moving parallel to the beach. Blaze glanced at Min. She nodded. The surface was too unstable for a running start, so he walked off the edge. Before he hit the water, he delved into the shadows. The ocean turned as dark as night, spangled with silver ripples. The water beneath his right foot felt like thick gelatin. He was sinking, but he was able to step forward, his left foot plunging mid-shin into the gummy ocean. The next step took him past his knee. Then he was wading, slogging forward, continuing to sink to his waist. Min flowed past him. She was doing a crawl stroke, but she seemed to be moving faster than she ought to be able, as if she had a rope around her waist and someone was hauling her in from shore. Blazer's momentum flagged. He leaned forward and pawed at the water. He hardly moved. The water wasn't helping, but the shadows within it could. He dipped into them and surged forward. It was cold, but not in the heat-leaching way of a wintry sea. He didn't feel all that wet yet, either. Very odd. He thought about going back for his cloak, but he could no longer see the raft. He continued toward shore. Rubbery mounds of black water rolled to all sides, alive with silvery foam. It felt like swimming, and yet not. With a frown, he wondered what would happen if he inhaled any of the thick liquid. Ahead, Min stood, slogging in to shore, waves tumbling up the sand and shining around her knees. Blaze dangled his legs and touched bottom. He followed her in. Once he was above the tide line, he stepped out of the shadows. He blinked against the overcast glare. He was damp rather than soaked, but he was tired of trying to make sense of this. He plopped in the sand and pulled on his boots. The beach was still empty. They stood and walked south toward the cave mouth. A stone's throw from the entrance, Min stopped. There was no entrance. Just blank, slabby basalt. Blaze cocked his head. This is it, isn't it?
Yes.
Then where's it?
They've closed it, she said.
They saw us coming. Blaze walked up to the wall and knocked where he thought the entry had been.
Well, that's rude.
It's their form of mercy. It's what they do when a stranger sails into the cove, but they don't want to kill him. I'm going to choose to interpret that as a positive sign. He glanced over his shoulder. What are you waiting for? Open it up.
I can't.
Forget how magic works, did you? Give it a try.
For me. So you can tell me I told you so.
She set her mouth in a skeptical line, but reached toward the rock. A vertical seam appeared. Rock flowed inward, concaving the wall in a spreading, egg-shaped depression. A moment later, rock poured back from the sides, obliterating her work. I told you so. She gave him a look and stepped back. They're watching from within. So, what if we come at it from over there? Blaze pointed where his old room must have been located inside the cliff.
They'll feel it and stop us.
Well, there has to be something we can do. He glared at the rock. Stupid rock, as solid as itself. The seal their antagonists had set up probably wasn't all that thick, but even if he had a tree trunk and a dozen burly men to hoist it, the people of the pocket would close up the wall faster than he could bash it down. We know you're in there.
It's no use, Min said. They have enough supplies to last for a year without stepping outside. It's standing policy. And as long as they're stuck in there, they've got nothing better to do than keep us out.
Blaze gazed at the basalt wall. Matter in the netherworld only showed some of the properties of its earthly counterparts. Water was sort of watery, sort of wet. Snow was kind of cold and a little bit soft. What if rock was only sort of hard? The certainty that he could walk through it flooded his marrow. He stepped into the shadows, then stepped to the wall, and rebounded from it, accompanied by a coconutty whack of his skull. He tumbled back into the real world, rubbing his forehead.
Shit!
Min laughed.
Did you just do what I think you did?
He ignored her. His problem was he tried to walk through the wall. He should have been trying to follow the nether into it. He vanished back into the twilight realm. The nether rested in the rock as it did in everything else. He felt himself in the nether in the air, in the layer of sand beneath his feet, in the salty vapor that hung in the air, in everything. He felt himself in the nether of the rock. He stepped forward. He popped out into a round chamber of rock, the pale, ethereal light inside it illuminating the faces of six extremely surprised-looking women.
"Fancy seeing you here," he said. "How many walls does a guy have to walk through to talk to Ro?"
The women stumbled back. Without turning his back on them, Blaze knocked three times on the outer wall. A moment later, daylight poured inside, followed by a dazed-looking Min.
"How did you do that?"
she said, chorused by two other people. A woman with her red hair in a bun gathered her wits.
"You cannot be in here."
"Yet here I am," Blaze said. "Want to get me out? Take me to see Ro."
"Not necessary."
Ro strode from the hallway, leading deeper into the tunnels, jaw clenched. She turned an incinerating gaze on the others.
Who let them in?
No one did,
the redhead squirmed. He walked through the wall, right through solid stone. Ro tightened her hand into a fist and turned on Min.
You know better than to come here.
I am in my rights to strike you dead.
Go ahead, she shrugged. If we leave without you, we're dead anyway.
Would be a shame to lose Min, Blaze said. Apparently she's a hell of a teacher.
Ro sighed louder than the surf banging up the shore.
Why did you leave us?
Weren't you happy?
It wasn't about that.
Min's voice dropped. A member of my family was being held captive. Without us, he might have died.
You know the vows.
Like my own name. Please, Ro, listen to what I have to say before forging your judgment.
Ro's jaw worked.
Speak then, knowing that my judgment is final and I will not hesitate to enforce it.
Min closed her eyes.
That's all I can ask.
Outside.
Without waiting for acknowledgement, Ro strode out the oval door Min had opened in the wall. Halfway to the surf, she sat in the sand, the wind teasing her gray-streaked hair about her face. Blaze and Min sat across from her. A handful of the others drifted after them, like a lost flock, looking to Ro for permission. She nodded, and they sat in a loose ring around the three.
Everything?
Min asked Blaze.
Everything.
He winked at Ro.
I trust her to keep a secret.
Min leaned forward, tracing her fingers through the sand.
It's a long story. Bear with me.
She began. Not with their decision to leave Pocket Cove, but with the story of what brought her to it. How she'd been cut away from her family by a father who looked at her not as a daughter or a person, but as a blasphemous witch, with no interest in her role as a vessel of motherhood. By the time she concluded the tale of her homelessness, Ro was the only one who looked unmoved. She'd heard this before, Blaze decided. Either that, or she really was that steely. Min shifted to the recent past, admitting that she'd kept in contact with her brother made her visibly uncomfortable, but she continued, explaining how she and Blaze had chosen to go to Wending to help her cousin. That they'd meant to be gone no longer than a week or two. Until they'd discovered that Selen was on the verge of its return, and that Modigan meant to take it.
So what? Ro interrupted. What does it matter to us, the useless strife of kings? Pocket Cove is separate from all of that. That's the very reason why we're here.
Selen is the one thing that could tear down our walls, Min said. Besides, I'm not finished.
Ro looked irritated, but made no further objections. Min moved through what they'd done at Setevan and the Norrin territories, explaining what had brought them to Dante, as well as his significance in this tangled game, and how, right when Blaze had made off with Selen, it had been snatched up by the Minister. Ro was staring at Blaze.
And if you'd hung on to it, what would you have done with it?
Me, he said. I honestly have no idea.
I have no time for coyness. No one quests for Selen without scheming what they'll do once it's theirs.
I really didn't give it that much thought. I just wanted to keep it away from the others.
He picked up a pearly little shell and rolled it around his palm. But you're right. I thought about it. If I'd kept it, I would have brought it to Setevan and played a giant, sky-spanning illusion of King Modigan being battered around by an enormous kitten.
An enormous?
Rose's face creased with angry confusion.
Why?
For laughs. Mostly to be rid of it.
I don't believe that.
She cleared her voice, enforcing its sternness.
Not for a second.
The minister comes from Wesley,
Min finished. He still blames Narashtivik for what we did to his land. Roe swung her head Min's way. Did you tell Narashtivik this? Don't they have a right to their own history? To know why they're about to be put to death? You don't understand how little that means to me. We haven't concerned ourselves with the outside world in centuries. All I care about is the safety of the people. Blaze snorted. You're not hiding here for your safety. If that were true, it wouldn't matter if your people came and went. Instead, you're hiding the shame of what you did to Wesley. I've seen plenty of self-loathing in my travels. It looks a lot like punishing your young by forcing them to swim naked in winter and spend days alone in the fingers. Those aren't punishments. They're training methods, and they certainly worked for you. We don't want much from you. A tunnel through the mountains. We're not going to massacre Wesley again. Just take Selen and maintain the status quo. He held her gaze. Your people will never be in harm's way, and you can walk away knowing you saved lives in the present and redeemed others in the past. Ro rolled her lips together. You really think the people of the pocket should shoulder the blame for something that happened 1,000 years ago? Only the people know that. If the minister knows about you, you can be certain he'll think so. She met eyes with each of the women sitting around her. No one spoke, yet there seemed to be an understanding flowing between them. The kind of communication that's only possible between people who have lived together so long, they know where the others stand without saying a word. Or maybe they were using arcane, sorcerous mind powers. Despite all he'd seen, there remained times when the world was too complex for Blaze to begin to guess. This tunnel, Rose said. Tell me what you'd have us do. Chapter 37. The ship cut through the waves with such speed, Dante suspected its crew must have some sway over the winds, as well as the earth. The seas were high and angry, yet the vessel seemed to skim along its surface like a skater on the frozen canals of Yalan. Technically speaking, there were probably better ways Dante could be spending his time, instead of standing on the docks watching its progress. Yet, along with the diplomatic angle, he thought that someone should be here. To watch the remnants of ancient Narashtivik rejoin, however temporarily, the city they'd once built. The ship hove in, bleeding speed. Its wood was dark and matte, its sails the blue-gray of the sea beneath an overcast sky. Unusual, but even if he hadn't known to look for it, the design wouldn't have surprised him. As with everything they did, it was meant to pass unseen. As it came to the pier, however, and the stevedores, sailors, and passengers milling around got a look at its crew, it drew considerable attention. With one exception, everyone on its decks was a woman. Ropes flew this way and that. Blaze grinned down from the railing. Of all the favors I've ever done you, count this as one of my finest. I can't imagine what you'll owe me. We can start with Narashtivik and take it from there. Dante crossed his arms. Suits me. Right now I'd count taking the city off my hands as another favor. Blaze disappeared for a while. People thumped around, securing ropes, moving cargo. They had a rope ladder, but Dante had gotten the dock workers to bring around a mobile staircase. The first woman to descend it was familiar to him. He'd seen the steel in her eyes before. We've met, she said. My name is Ro. Dante bowed. The debt we'll owe you will be eternal. We're not here to earn debts. We're here to pay one off. She gazed past him to the city. An unreadable expression settled on her face. But there are conditions. First, The pathway is all we do. Once it's complete, we return home. We owe you the chance to save yourselves, but we'll take no part in punishing Wesley a second time. I would do the same. Second, while they work, my people are to be left in peace. No questions about how they do what they do, or about any element of Pocket Cove, no matter how trivial. You will treat us like a tool. You don't ask a hammer how it drives the nail. Roe, I mean it when I say we're in your debt, up to our ears. I would never think of trying to use you for more. I haven't kept my people alive and untroubled by trusting the kindness of strangers. She gave him a hard look, then smiled enough to soften its edges. Third and last, don't hurt the Wesleyans worse than you have to. We're not here to help you commit genocide. The minister killed my friend. I will kill him if I get the chance. Dante inclined his head. But I have no hate for his people. I'll do my best to keep them out of the fire. Roe looked to the city again. Then there is nothing stopping us from working together. Her people had come down the stairs to gather behind her. Dante made a sweeping gesture toward the two spires at the center of town. Welcome to Narashtovik. He led the procession back to the citadel. She had brought 50 people with her, and he could feel their power in the air. 50 Nethermancers, all of whom were as strong as his monks, and some of whom must surely rival the council. Their potential was intoxicating, enough to topple a kingdom. If they were to join him in earnest, it might be enough to reduce the minister's army to ashes. That was a fantasy, of course. The people of the pocket could never be cajoled or coerced into a war. Part of him was amazed Blaze had convinced them to come at all. He moved next to Blaze, who looked right pleased with himself. Well done. But while you were out and about, would it have killed you to enlist a dragon or three? Blaze scoffed. If you're not satisfied with my witch army, I can send them straight home. They drew plenty of looks on the way to the citadel. He had no idea how much time the people of the pocket spent outside their isolated homeland, but if they were impressed by the city, most of them hid it well. Some looked contemplative, almost yearning. Was it just a matter of being back in civilization, or was it a deeper connection to the city their ancestors had helped create? The streets smelled like wood smoke and melting snow. It was as lively as ever. Rumors had swirled concerning the frenetic comings and goings of the sealed citadel, but as far as Dante knew, the people weren't aware they stood on the brink of invasion. He hoped they'd remain ignorant until he finished his business in Wesley. The citadel gates rolled open, revealing rows of Norran yurts erected on the cobbles of the courtyard. "What's the matter with you?" Blaze said. You don't even have the decency to let your volunteer sleep inside. Dante walked down the corridor the warriors had left down the middle of the encampment. I offered. You know how they are. A fleet of servants materialized to show the women to their housing in the monks' chambers. The monks, meanwhile, had been relocated to the barracks that had emptied a few days ago when they'd sent the troops and the bulk of the slow-moving mule teams ahead toward the Wodens. There they'd met up with Ast, who'd been sent into the mountains more than a week ago in order to scout a location to begin the tunnel. It was a lot of shuffling about, considering the people would only be in Narashtovik for one night. But everything else was already prepared, and Gant seemed pleased to be occupied with a new majordomo challenge. Dante took Roe up to the council chambers. The others were already there. As she entered, they stood and bowed their heads. She glanced at Dante. What's this? Tarkan stepped forward.
Thank you, my lady. Not just for answering our call to aid, but for making this place what it is.
A smile creased her mouth.
It may shock you to learn that I had nothing to do with the founding, or Narashtivik, or your order. But thank you for making me feel incredibly old.
Trust me, I've got decades on you.
Tarkon smiled back, the resulting wrinkles proving his claim.
We know we're talking of a time before we were a twinkle in Aron's stars. Despite that, and the fact we only learned of our shared history a few weeks ago, it means something to us that your people have returned.
Dante introduced her to the others, particularly those who would be traveling with them, which included Sombor, Ulov, and Pinya. Dante would have liked to bring more, but they needed to keep the bulk of their forces in reserve, particularly Ollivander, who would oversee the defense if Dante failed, and Nak, who operated the priceless network of loons. The remainder of the day sped by, for some reason. Dante had let himself be talked into hosting a feast, and he found himself dragged into its arrangements. Late afternoon, with sunshine pouring through the vast windows of the Winter Hall, the guests began to stream in. Council members, monks, soldiers, Norrin, women of the pocket. Gant had scheduled things that even the servants tasked to see the event would have half the evening off to enjoy it. Dante didn't see Blaze, but wasn't surprised by his absence. There was food of all kinds at the dinner, but after the fact he couldn't remember what. And not just because of the four cups of wine he had along with it, rather, what he remembered were those present, and the mood they'd brought to the feast with them. The gravity of an uncertain future, but the undaunted resolve of a people united in that future's defense. Once the main course, roast birds of some sort, had been picked apart, Tarkon stood, cleared his throat, and waited for silence.
And now, if you will indulge him, the head of our order would like to say a few words.
Dante thought he met Ollivander. Then, to his horror, eyes turned his way instead. He gave Tarkon a withering look, but the old man defied him by remaining firmly alive. Dante sighed inwardly. Speeches. One of the many weights that dragged down the mantle of command. And stood.
I won't be too maudlin, he said. Or too windy. But if this is the last time I see you, I want you to know what an honor it's been to serve with you.
He stopped. 200 faces watched him, wanting more. Frustration mounted in his chest, as hot as a lump of potatoes you have to swallow before it scalds you. A place like this, like Narashtivik, is much more than the person who leads it. It's borne along on the shoulders of everyone here. Don't fear for it. You've already built it. It can't be taken away. He realized that he was done, and sat down. During the applause, he wondered how much of his speech he believed. As the night wore on, a great many people came to speak to him, one on one. They meant well, but it felt ominous, as if no one in the room expected him to return. But the morning came, as it always did, and he was still alive, as he had been for the last quarter of a century. In the courtyard, the Norrin had rolled up their yurts, ready to march. The people of the pocket stood apart in a single cluster. The scouts and soldiers joked and shot the breeze. They'd probably been down here for an hour. Dante was disgraced by the idea he was the last to arrive. But 5 minutes later, Blaze walked out the front door. As they moved out, Dante was on horseback, but many of the troops, most of Roe's people, and all of the Norrin were not. He didn't look back at the city. He thought he'd see it again. Besides, he knew it so well that one last look wouldn't give him anything he didn't have already. Quite a few people came out to watch them go. Some were there to try to figure out why such a force was departing, but others were there for the sheer spectacle. They had over 200 people on the march, and the assortment was motley, to say the least. Dante smiled to himself and refused to answer a single question from the crowd. Their band made good time on the road east, camping in the woods that night and moving on at first light. Dante was kept busy with discussions with the other council members, scouts and Knack. As the sunset of the second day approached, with the mountains hanging to the east like a fortress of the gods, Blaze rode up beside him. "It always feels strange, doesn't it?" "Heading out like this," Dante chuckled. "It has always amazed me that the weightiest task is able to sit on the rational mind without leaving the faintest impression. We should be running away and changing our names, right? Yet here I am, wondering when we're going to eat dinner. Our bodies must recognize how many pairs of breeches we've brought with us, and will only allow our brains to start soiling them once we get close enough to our destination to have enough spares. Or, what if we're just that dumb?" Blaze said. "Like, we can't be that afraid of a bear until it's actually eating our leg." Dante thought there might be some truth to that. He probably wouldn't begin to feel it until they'd returned to Wesley. Even then, they'd have a ways to go before the terror set in. They made it up into the foothills without incident, catching up with the supply caravan, which had encamped a ways below Sol to avoid cappers and excess snow. Coordinating through Knack, Dante arranged to meet Ast and his team there. The next morning, the entire village came out to watch them arrive. As the troops settled in for a meal, Dante gathered the council members, Ro, Blaze, and Min, and met with Ast in the meadow, away from the others. "Found a route?" Dante asked Ast. He nodded. "Given the nature of your plans, it wasn't exactly difficult. It is perhaps a 2-day hike from here. That is when the going gets rough enough to justify traveling under the mountains instead." "Any sign of cappers?" "Some tracks, nothing too recent. We had good luck on our return crossing too. Either they've bedded down for the winter, or I wonder if they were drawn to the minister instead." "I doubt we're that lucky," Dante said. "That's the plan, then. Hike to the site. There's too many of us for a cave. Ro, can your people help me build a wall around ourselves each night?" The woman frowned as if he'd insulted her. "A wall? To keep out the cappers. They're real. Even with a wall, we're going to want sentries." "This isn't something I'll want to protect my people from on our way back." "Absolutely. And we'll want to keep the entrance of the tunnel too small for one to get inside. I'll fill you in on the march." Her cheek twitched.
"I would have appreciated knowing about this complication ahead of time."
"It didn't occur to me," Dante said. "And given the cappers are impervious to almost everything except gravity, your people should have no problem handling them. I wouldn't be surprised if, after your people left Narashtovik, those who remained in the city created the cappers to stop Wesleyan Nethermancers from trying to cross over."
"I wouldn't know that."
Ro tapped her arm, then nodded once.
"We'll continue, but I expect to know everything there is to know."
"Of course. If there's nothing further, we should move on. With a group this size, it may take longer than we've anticipated." He gave the troops a few more minutes to eat, then spread the word that it was time to pack up camp. The villagers watched them go. As they moved into the forest, Morn approached him, towering over the humans.
"My scouts took it upon themselves to range ahead,"
he informed Dante.
"I hope you don't think I'm being presumptuous."
Dante glanced up at him. "Why would I mind you putting your people to use?"
"Because you're used to doing things your way, and we're used to doing things ours."
"Just make sure they're back by dusk, for their own safety." With a bevy of people, animals, and supplies, he expected it to be slower going than their initial trip across the Wodens. As they approached their first spread of talus, he sighed inwardly, pricking his ears for the animal scream that meant a mule had broken its leg and needed healing.